Good afternoon. My name is Bill Lawrence. I have the privilege of serving as the dean at Perkins School of Theology here at Southern Methodist University. And that means, among other things, I have the privilege of welcoming you to the first of our fall 2014 Faith and Business Luncheons. What I will do is say a word about the nature of the Faith and Business Luncheons. Then I'm going to introduce both speakers, and then they will get up and follow each other sequentially so that the move from the first of the speakers to the second of the speakers will be uninterrupted. A word first about the nature of the Faith and Business Luncheons. We at Perkins School of Theology became very aware that there was both a need and an opportunity for us to be part of the effort that Southern Methodist University is making and has made to build stronger connections and stronger relationships between the educational community that sits on what we generally call the hilltop and the larger community of business, civic, professional leadership. And in an effort to solidify those relationships and generate new ones, a couple of members of the support team, the leadership team, including current and former members of the executive board, notably Dodie Crockett and John Castle, forged the idea to create faith and business luncheons like this, where generous donors would make it possible for a group of people to come together for a meal, where we would have an opportunity to hear from a member of the business, professional, civic community, and a member of the Perkins faculty, where the two of them together, ideally on some common theme, would be able to reflect on what it means to have the power of faith at work in one's practice as a person in business, and vice versa, what it means for a person in business to be able to be a resource and a source of information for those of us who work primarily in the faith or in the theological education community. So it really emerged from the first as a partnership. At each of these, and we have two each semester, we not only invite members of the community to come and enjoy the meal and hear the speakers, but we invite one person who is a leader in the business community, one person who is a leader among the faculty here at Perkins, to serve as our two faith and business luncheon speakers. They will give their separate talks back to back, and then as time permits, John Martin will try to facilitate a Q&A and take as many questions as time permits, or will tell you there isn't time, and that's okay too. Let me now introduce to you our two speakers, starting with the one from whom you will hear first. Ruth Fitzgibbons is brand public relations principal in Richards Partners. From the moment at age 7, when Ruth began her business career by setting up her lemonade stand and made the front page of the Dallas Morning News for doing so, her career was set. She had 2 decades as a reporter and editor for national and regional magazines. She became then the agency's public relations guru in 1994. She has grown the PR discipline from 1 employee and 1 client to its current size of 30 professionals serving more than 40 companies, institutions, and organizations. She has counseled clients in a wide array of categories from the ridiculous, that's not my word. They're not a client anymore. This was, are you ready for this? Pasta-based pet food. Can you understand why they're not a client anymore? Maybe Ruth will tell you more about that. Anyway, from that kind of client to the American Heart Association START program, an extraordinarily important client, I'm sure. Ruth's commitment to cause branding and strategic communications for nonprofits has led to the growth of a substantial practice area in service to universities, healthcare institutions, charities, foundations, museums, and corporate partnerships. In 2006, the Hyundai Hope on Wheels Tour for Pediatric Cancer Research won a prestigious national Halo Award. She began her career in New York, well, after that lemonade stand. She began her formal career in New York, where she was editor and writer for several national periodicals, including New York Magazine, The New York Times, Cosmopolitan, Ladies' Home Journal. After returning to her native Dallas, Ruth became editor-in-chief of D Magazine, which was named the best city magazine in the United States. She is a member and former president of the Dallas Assembly, a member of the Dallas chapter of the International Women's Forum, serves as an advisor to the Booker T. Washington High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. Ruth has two grown sons, and this is her word, an adorable grandson. Oh, you're up to three grandchildren now? And they're all adorable, of course. When Ruth isn't spending free time with the family, she enjoys snow skiing, power walking, cooking, chick-lit, and traveling. Please greet Ruth Fitzgibbons. Our second luncheon speaker is Dr. Alice McKenzie. The Reverend Dr. Alice McKenzie is the Levan Professor of Preaching and Worship at Perkins School of Theology. She is an ordained United Methodist minister, a clergy member of the North Texas Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church, earned a BA degree in the History of Religions from Bryn Mawr College, then went to Duke Divinity School, where she earned a Master of Divinity degree, and followed that with a PhD in homiletics from Princeton Theological Seminary. She has served as a pastor of local churches in central and eastern Pennsylvania. She has taught preaching in a number of places, including Princeton Seminary, but has spent almost the entirety of her academic career as a scholar and teacher here at Perkins. She is both a Bible scholar, whose work on the wisdom literature of the Old Testament has been internationally recognized, and in her primary responsibilities, a teacher of preachers. She accomplishes that role, that second role, the teacher of preachers, in a number of ways. Here at Perkins School of Theology, teaching master's level students who are preparing for careers in ministry that include the work of preaching, but also in teaching continuing education programs for persons who are active in ministry and are looking for ways to make their preaching more effective. And she has been an active preacher herself. In fact, more recently, she was on the staff of Christ United Methodist Church in Plano, serving as a member of their preaching team so that she was preaching regularly and so that she was conducting, at their invitation, a critical and constructive assessment of the sermons delivered by the members of the ministerial staff at Christ United Methodist Church. Her publications are spread widely across the fields of wisdom literature, preaching. She has written such books as Preaching Proverbs, Wisdom for the Pulpit, Preaching Biblical Wisdom in a Self-Help Society, Hear and Be Wise, Becoming a Teacher and Preacher of Wisdom, Novel Preaching, which is about fiction writing strategies for sermons. Not that sermons are fiction, but preachers can learn from fiction writers. And perhaps one of her more interesting titles for preachers, What Not to Say. Practical Advice for Provocative Preaching. She's currently working on a study of biblical wisdom that is entitled Save Your Receipt and Exchanging Fear for Faith. Now, I want to tell you that in addition to her teaching and research and writing, Alice McKenzie has also been active in a number of areas, member of the Board of Ordained Ministry of the North Texas Conference, which is the group that recommends persons for ordination in the United Methodist Church. And about a year ago, she was invited to submit a proposal, and I'm pleased to say it was a successful proposal to receive for Perkins School of Theology and for her work a grant from the Lilly Endowment that will assist her in the work that she is doing in teaching preaching. Now, when she and I talked about the form that this grant might take, we knew, she knew, and I concurred, that one of the things we should do is establish a center that would focus on preaching here at Perkins School of Theology with such a grant. And the grant was received, but along the way she said, now, what should we call this thing? You know, we could call it a center for preaching excellence, but that might sound a little arrogant. Perhaps we should call it the Center for Preaching Mediocrity. Or the Center for Preaching Adequacy. But we decided to go for the whole deal, and we do indeed now have a Center for Preaching Excellence at Perkins School of Theology with Alice McKenzie as the director. Please join me in welcoming Alice. Ruth, we look forward to your presentation.
Whoops. Well, I need that back in my pocket. Let me just get this situated. All right. Well, I am truly humbled and honored to be with you today. I see a lot of friendly faces. This is something that I've been looking forward to for a number of months now. So I appreciate very much being part of this group. I've heard great things about these lunches. But when I got a call last spring from Dodi Crockett, whom I much admire, as do I know many of you in this room, I thought she must have me mixed up with somebody. Because, excuse me, I don't think of myself as someone who would be identified as a Christian at work. And I think we all know people who have done a phenomenal job of forming Bible studies around business days, but I had never really followed that path. So I was a little surprised to be invited here. It took a few days to consider the request, prayerfully consider the request, and I decided that this was exactly what I needed to really spearhead and maybe speed up a little bit an intentional journey into my own faith and to my own calling, and to examine for myself, really, how faith and work kind of work together. I thought, this is a God moment. Maybe it was his idea of sort of a forced a period of focus for me. However, I got busy over the spring and the summer, and I didn't really get very far on the talk. I did some thinking about it occasionally, and I read a little bit here and there. But as you heard, my life, the early part of my career as a magazine writer and editor was producing on deadline. And so actually, the deadline wasn't until last night. So, I even with 2 weeks in glorious Telluride, Colorado, an inspired place to think and write if there ever was one, I really hadn't gotten too far. Then, last Wednesday evening, I had just arrived at the Marriott Hotel in Dayton, Ohio, for the National Advisory Board meeting of the Salvation Army. If you're not familiar with the Salvation Army, it's the largest social services provider in the country and the largest client by far that Richards Partners has ever had. Richards Partners is, by the way, part of the Richards Group, which is a larger advertising branding firm, in case that wasn't obvious. Waiting for the shuttle to go to dinner, I was standing around with some other people waiting for the shuttle to go to dinner, and I was introduced to a woman that I had never met before who was from Dallas. So as women do, we had each other's entire life story down by the time we got to dinner, but we started chatting, and she started talking about her life, and we immediately found several friends we had in common, including Don Williams, who was a mentor to her, former CEO, chairman of Trammell Crow, was a mentor to her in her career and was really responsible for the transition that I made from D Magazine to the work I'm doing now. And it went on. She talked a little bit more about 10 years ago having formed a organization that writes to and for and organizes professional Christian women. And, of course, I saw in her portfolio a book. And I said, could you give me that, please? Now. To add to the serendipity, it turns out that Diane Paddington was going to be here today. So, thank you, Diane. I devoured your book. I had it completely read by the time I landed at DFW on the way home from Dayton. And if you haven't read Work, Love, Pray, she tells her story very, very charmingly through this book. And really, it was the encouragement and the impetus and the catalyst that I needed to really figure out how to tell my own story. So thank you, Diane. So I titled my talk, An Accidental Journey to a Purposeful Life. I always loved headlines the most, so I had that written months ago. But in truth, I'm actually probably an accidental Christian as well. My parents could never quite decide whether they were Methodist or Presbyterian. And after a while, my father really couldn't decide whether he bought into organized religion at all. So in my formative years growing up, they played golf on Sundays. But I had a crush on a boy who went to Preston Hollow Presbyterian Church. So at the age of 16, on my own, I joined the youth group there. And Preston Hollow has been my church family ever since, even after living 11 years in New York, marrying an Irish Catholic, coming back to Dallas, having two sons, one of whom now says he's an agnostic. And my own journey as a seeker and a questioner and sometimes a doubter, but always a steadfast member of that congregation and that church. And I think having this opportunity to have the exercise to look back on your life and understand what were the God moments and what are the gifts and what can you discern from what his plan was for you has been really profound and illuminating and inspiring. So thank you, Dodie. Thank you, Dodie. And John Castle, because I know you were part of that too. So for me, as I look back, it starts with my parents. And my parents were many things, as all parents are. But I'll focus on a couple of them. My father played the piano by ear. He could sit down and pound out everything from Dave Brubeck to Dixieland to Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which I belted out by his side. And at some point, I realized that I also could play the piano by ear. But it wasn't until years later that I understood what this God-given musical ability would mean in my life. I moved to New York right out of college. This was the early 70s, where women were just beginning to stream into the workforce. And my friends and I, three other girls from Dallas, were really looking for adventure. The careers we might have found were kind of accidental as well. To be truthful, we probably were really just looking for husbands because it seemed like most girls at the time snagged one in college. but we hadn't done that. So off we went to New York. And I landed a job as an editorial assistant at a magazine that was about interior design, which I knew absolutely nothing about, nor did I know what an editorial assistant was, but that's, you kind of figure that out. But after about 6 months there, they allowed me to start writing these little short news briefs, and my boss was very complimentary about my writing. And she also liked to say that I was a perfect mimic, which either I was imitating people in the office. I can't really remember this, but I'm going to choose to think that what she meant was that I was able to absorb the language and the rhythm of this industry we were writing for and feed that back through my writing, my prose. Well, one day I realized that I tap my foot as I write. And something that I have done my entire career. When I'm writing, I am tapping to make sure that the rhythm of the language is the way I obviously think it should be. And it really was even back in those early days of writing that I realized that this musical ability that I had inherited and experienced with my father was probably going to be the key to my ability to write. And my ability to write, even through both sides of my career, has propelled every work success I have ever had. So that is a gift that I see now that can stream through everything that I've been able to do. The other influence I see when I look back at my parents is my father's passion for helping people who were less fortunate than we were. My father was a force of a man, sixth-generation Texan, nicknamed Moose, played tackle at Rice, a booming, hail fellow, well-met kind of a man. And when I was growing up, people who were in some sort of trouble or going through a difficult time would show up on our doorstep to seek his guidance. And I really didn't understand it at the time. But when he died suddenly at the age of 61, the stories that were told, and sometimes are still told to me when I run into people who knew and loved him, put his life in a perspective that I realize now had an indelible imprint on mine. He was one of the Dallas leaders that helped usher Dallas through desegregation in a peaceful way. He was one of the founders of the Salesmanship Club's youth camp for troubled youth. And he had an insatiable curiosity. At dinner, we talked about everything from politics and history to religion to the origins of the universe. So fast forward to my return to Dallas from that decade plus in magical Manhattan, and I joined the staff at D Magazine. I was right in the middle of our family dinner table again, with daily discussions about the people and the politics and the dynamics that make Dallas such a fascinating place to live. Well, this was the early 80s, and for those of you who were here then, they were turbulent times. the city council had gone from kind of a white oligarchy to a representative, a single member form of government, and harmony was not the rule of the day. Race relations were very, very tense, and we did our best at D to do the right thing with every article we published, but there was a lot of gray area, and my moral compass was tested on a daily basis, and I believe that it was really this period that I remember really relishing that Sunday morning refuge at church and being able to listen to scripture and great preachers, and really it sort of reset the compass for the weeks ahead. People were always furious at me and at the magazine, no matter what we did. If we did the 10 best hamburgers, everybody else's hamburger was mad. So it was a tricky role. And even at church one day, I'll never forget this, the spouse of someone that we had written something fairly snarky about, I'm sure, came click, click, clicking in her high heels across the gymnasium with my two little kids that I just picked up from Sunday school and just reamed me out. And I thought, I've had as much fun as I could possibly have here, and it's time for me to find a new chapter. So I searched for the next role, and another God moment. Through an acquaintance that I had known at the Dallas Assembly, I learned that the Richards Group was looking for someone to come and help build its public relations practice. And in those interim months before that, I had been working with the Dallas Citizens Council, helping them develop their agenda for how the business community could do good in the city of Dallas. And it really had made me realize that I could take this gift I had to write and to communicate, and everything I'd learned about media and strategic communications, and use that for good with the civic and the nonprofit community. That was my plan. So I landed an interview at the Richards Group, and I had an interview with Stan Richards, and I expounded upon this idea of mine to take these talents and put them to good for the community. And there was a very long silence, and the man who has urged America to eat more chicken for many years now said, "That sounds like pro bono work." So that probably wasn't the best strategy for an interview, but right then he actually agreed that if we could build up a for-profit part of our public relations practice, we could do all the nonprofit work that we wanted to. And by the way, it's not pro bono, but we do have nonprofit rates. And that was 20 years ago. I would never have thought I could have enjoyed a job as much as I did at D Magazine, but I have been so blessed to work with a man who is of such integrity and passion himself, who has become such a compass for so many of us that are allowed to do good work and have fun doing it. One of my colleagues, David Hall, is here. I think he would concur. Almost from the beginning, I saw this tremendous pool of talent. There were about 200 of us 20 years ago. There are 700 of us now. People who are experts in strategy and who are genius at creative, and how could we marshal these forces to help the nonprofit community? And I'm thrilled that today we can say we've helped dozens of nonprofits. Some of you are in the room now: Parkland, the Dallas Foundation, the Bridge, City Square. We've been able to take the disciplines and the processes that made the Home Depot great and made Chick-fil-A now sell more chicken than KFC in 6 days, not seven, to work for helping the homeless and serving the underserved. And it's truly been the blessing of my career. So today, 90% of my time is spent with working with people just like my father, people who work tirelessly to help the less fortunate and to right social wrongs and serve human need. So there was one more element of this, though, that I needed to think about, which is, do I live my faith out at work? And if I do, how? And I came to a passage in Diane's book called, a little section she called Show, Don't Tell. Well, first of all, that is my favorite axiom about writing. I've probably exhorted, you know, dozens of writers over the years to show me, don't tell me. So it caught my eye immediately. But in this context, it means actions speak louder than words. And Diane here quotes St. Francis of Assisi, who said, I'll get it exactly right, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." And I thought, I love that. I mentioned the Salvation Army earlier, and what a fascinating experience it has been to get to know these extraordinary people for whom doing the most good, the brand that was created by Stan Richards and the Richards Group more than a decade ago, so perfectly describes their humble stewardship of God's kingdom in Jesus' name. And I've spent a lot of time over the past year visiting Salvation Army offices and programs. And they start every meeting with a devotional. They pray several times during the meeting. And at first I thought, is this going to be kind of awkward? this much praying in a business section? And I have decided I really look forward to these meetings. These devotionals are phenomenal. The way these officers live their faith is such a high bar for any of us who even want to think of weaving our faith through our vocational calling. But the idea of seeking discernment and offering gratitude to God at every meeting just may stick, even if it's a silent and a private prayer. Last week, one of the officers prayed for me to have the wisdom to help the Salvation Army tell their story more effectively so that they can bring more people into their fight to help people. And that has been a profound experience as well. And I'm pretty sure a God moment that's going on its second year now. So the God moments are happening more frequently now, or maybe I'm just better able to see them. But I humbly thank you for giving me this opportunity to not only bear witness to my growing faith, but to find it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ruth. It was a great pleasure to get to know Ruth and to talk and collaborate on our mutual remarks. Now, you know, Oscar Wilde wrote a play with a very sexy title called The Importance of Being Earnest. Remember that? So my remarks today have just a slightly less sexy title, and my title is The Importance of Paying Attention. All right, are you excited about that? The importance of paying attention. But, you know, if you're not paying attention, you do miss things. Who knew this was a school zone? Right? Well, ma'am, you know, perhaps the flashing yellow light and the sign
could have tipped you off. Or who knew this event was black tie? Well, perhaps the embossed capital letters at the bottom of the invitation could have clued you in. If you're not paying attention, you might just miss something. So the topic of my response to Ruth is the importance of paying attention. And I really appreciated the way that she described her life as a series of God moments in which she was guided to recognize and to use her gifts for God. But you have to be paying attention to notice those moments. Several years ago, in my introduction to preaching class, PR6300, if you care, I have my students get up. You remember these fond memories, or do you have PTSD or fond memories? Okay. So I have the students stand up, and they share their name and where they're from, the extent of their preaching experience, their denomination, and then I have them, if they're a second career student, to talk about what they did in their former life. And so one time, this young man in his late 30s stood up and shared all that info, and then at the end, he said this. He said, "For the past 12 years, I have been a high school band director. But then I got a calling to do something significant with my life. And so I'm on the ordination track." Now, I was in the band in high school. And I was a shy, nerdy girl. And I was in the band. I played the clarinet in the concert band. I played the bass clarinet in the marching band. And I was shy and nerdy, but I was a band member. And so I didn't jump up and go shake him. That's not appropriate. But I did think to myself, I thought, haven't you been noticing what God has been doing in your life for the past 12 years? Are you really trying to tell me that helping teenagers find confidence has no significance? I mean, are you really trying to tell me that that helping instill a lifelong love of music in young people has no significance, that helping teenagers build confidence and have community has no significance. You know, there are many talents in this room, and I know that we don't have all afternoon, so I can't list all of them. Don't have that much time. But I do know that through them, you all provide important products and services. You provide opportunities for people and their families. And I would just hope that we have some sense already that God is calling you and me to use our gifts, to discern our gifts, and to see that we are already making a contribution to God's good work in what we do in our workaday lives. The alternative is to wait for some bright and distant day when God will finally notice us and call us to do something significant with our lives. Can I get an amen? All right. So in Jewish understanding, all work participates in what they call tikkun olam, which is God at work to repair the creation. All work participates in tikkun olam. Martin Luther articulated a Christian understanding of work in the 1500s. He believed that we all have different offices. I don't mean cubicles or corner offices with windows, but roles, what we do for a living, but that we all have one common vocation. And that common vocation, well, the word vocation comes from the Latin vocare, which means to call. That common vocation is to be God's person in the world. To be God's person in the world. It is to confess and to live out our faith in Jesus Christ as we contribute in what we do every day to a more compassionate, more just world. We all have a common vocation. So our common vocation, as Ruth described it in her experience, I think boils down to paying attention to those moments in which God is speaking to us, helping us discern what our gifts are, helping us to discern how to use those gifts. We know that Jesus often retreated in his busy days and nights to times of prayer in which he sought out God moments so that he could be strengthened and refreshed in his ministry. In 1 Kings 3, young King Solomon, to whom tradition ascribes the book of Proverbs, I personally doubt that he had enough time, given all of his many wives and concerns, to. But anyway, they're attributed to him. And in the scene in 1 Kings 3, he has just received an undeserved promotion. He didn't have a good interview. That's not why he got promoted. He didn't get good recommendations. That's not why he got promoted. He got promoted because his daddy died. And here he is. He's young. He's intimidated. He is facing, with probably rather thin adolescent shoulders, all the weight of new responsibilities. And we all know how smooth transitions in family-owned businesses are. So there he is. His father was just a charismatic, multi-talented, wildly popular king, that's all. So he's on Mount Gibeon, and he goes up to pray and offer sacrifices. And God appears to Solomon in a dream and says, "What do you want most? And I will give it to you." Solomon gives a good answer. He says, in the Hebrew, "Give me a lev shomea." Give me a lev shomea. Which could be translated a discerning mind, or also could be rendered a listening heart. You like mixed metaphors? A listening heart. It doesn't much matter because for the Hebrew understanding, the heart was not just the seat of our hallmark emotions, but it was the seat of pretty much everything, character, decision-making, as well as emotions. Give me a listening heart. In other words, he's saying, "Help me, Lord. Help me, Lord. Help me to pay attention to you in the encounters that lie ahead, in which I'm going to be asked to make some very difficult decisions." He asked for a listening heart just at the right time because do you remember what waits for him at the bottom of the mountain? Two women, both laying claim to the same baby. "Give to me a listening heart so that I might be able to govern this great people." The wise teachers of Israel understood that the listening heart, paying attention to God's presence and guidance in our daily lives, is the key habit that we need to cultivate to live a wise life. And so important was this quality of the listening heart, paying attention, that they believed that it was a gift from God. And in Proverbs 20:12, they say this, "A listening ear and a seeing eye, the Lord indeed hath made them both." A listening ear and a seeing eye, the Lord indeed hath made them both. Now, I have coined a name for this quality, kind of branded it, actually. I call it not KFC, but KFN. And KFN stands for Knack for Noticing. Knack for Noticing. I got this idea when I took the then chair of the English department at SMU, Charles Smith, who's a novelist and teaches creative writing. I took him to lunch. I was working on the book Novel Preaching, and I said, "Charles, I said, what advice do you have for my preachers that we can learn from novelists?" And he said, "Tell your preachers to pay attention. Tell your preachers to pay attention." He said, "I spend most of my time teaching 18-year-olds creative writing. And first I have to teach them to notice what they see. And then I need to teach them that there is some significance in what they have seen. Notice what you see and have some confidence that there's significance in what you have noticed. Tell your preachers to pay attention." Hence, Knack for Noticing. So now Ruth talked about God moments, moments of clarity in which we see with 20/20 hindsight what God has been doing in our lives or is seeking to do. I have to confess that some of the God moments in Scripture are just so dramatic that I feel kind of inadequate by comparison, because I have never seen a burning bush. If you have, you know, feel superior to me. I have never been blinded by the risen Lord as I commute back and forth from Allen to SMU in my Hyundai Sonata on 75. Well, it's good. That's a good thing, I guess, that I haven't. But I also have never heard God speak out of a whirlwind. I'm not Job. I'm not Moses. I'm not Paul. But I have to say I have had some God moments, which were clear enough for me anyway, to be the spiritual equivalent of being knocked upside the head. They were enough for me. My initial call was one of them. I was sitting in history class at age 15, and I experienced a strong assurance that God wanted me to be a pastor. I countered that feeling immediately with the objection, "That can't be right. Public speaking makes me nauseous." Apparently, God is not a God who accepts excuses as reasons, either now or in the Bible. My next God moment came. There are many others, but I'll do some selective filtering here. Next God moment would be fast forward 10 years. I've graduated from Bryn Mawr College. I've graduated from Duke Divinity School, and I've gone back to Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And I'm an associate pastor at what we consider in Pennsylvania, Dean Lawrence, to be a megachurch. 1,200 members. Woohoo! Actually, 1,252. It always stayed at that number, up and down, but always at that number. So there I was. My first sermon, I stand up in the pulpit, and I look out over a sea of faces. And they had a look on them of... I'm exaggerating, but it was a look of, "We're hungry." Expectancy. Expectancy. What do you have for us, preacher? And I thought to myself, there must be some more things I could learn about this to do it better. And then the thought came to me very clearly, someday you can teach this. Someday you're going to teach this. I moved on. You know, it's easy to move on and think, that was a weird thought. Fast forward 8 years, I now have 2 children, 6 and 2. I got married, I didn't mention that. I got married, have 2 children, 6 and 2. Married a member of the church, which I realized was inappropriate, but... So at any rate, I'm at Princeton Seminary, and I am in a graduate seminar on how to interpret Old Testament genres of literature for the 20th century church, since it was 1989. And I was only 7 minutes late. I mean, come on, 7 minutes. So I trudge up the steps of Stuart Hall with my 12-pound portable computer in hand. And as I walk in, the other students are passing around a clipboard, and they're signing up for our 30-page paper, which is due in 2 weeks, on interpreting a genre of the Old Testament for today. Somebody had already nabbed the patriarchal narratives. Someone had grabbed the Psalms, lapped up Leviticus, purloined the prophets. The lone genre of Old Testament literature left with no name next to it was the Book of Proverbs. My friend Scott leaned over and smirked. Good luck getting a sermon out of a one-liner. So I went home. I put the kids to bed. I opened the Book of Proverbs, expecting to find what United Methodist preacher and author Will Willimon says about Proverbs. Reading the Book of Proverbs is like taking a long road trip with your mom. But instead, which all the moms here agree would be good for our children, wouldn't it? Good. So instead, I opened it. I did one of those things where you just open the book, and I came upon this. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not rely on your own instincts. In all your ways, acknowledge God, and God will make straight your paths. I thought, I can get with that. I can get with that. And after that, as they say, one thing led to another. I ended up getting hooked on Proverbs and the other wisdom portions of the Bible, Ecclesiastes, Job, and Jesus' short sayings and parables, writing a bunch of stuff about it and teaching about it, and all because I was 7 lousy minutes late for class and nobody else wanted the Proverbs. And one more God moment. Dean Lawrence referred to it earlier. This one came last January when I received a letter from John Wimmer, who was a grant officer at the Lilly Foundation in Indiana, in response to the grant proposal that I had written to launch the Perkins Center for Preaching Excellence. Now, you know when you get letters, and at the beginning they try to make you feel sorry for them that they're about to reject you? No? You've never written letters like that? Never gotten a letter like that? Well, here we go. So I opened the letter, and I always read the first line, of course, and it did not begin in this way. Dear Dr. McKenzie, the decision on which institutions to grant funds to this year was made difficult by the high blah, 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 blah. Did not say that. Instead, it said, Dear Dr. McKenzie, we are pleased to inform you. I thought, okay, let's read on. So they informed us that they were giving us $500,000 grant to launch a Perkins Center for Preaching Excellence, which is a five-year grant that they would like for us to have be self-sustaining within the end of that time period. So the center, I was very excited about this because the center is going to be committed to fostering excellence in the teaching and preaching in our seminary classrooms through some fresh new courses, and also through forming peer groups, which is one of the best ways to learn to preach. You get together with maybe 10 preachers and a facilitator. You intentionally look at each other's sermons. Everyone loves that, right? And you work on it. You work on it together over a two-year period. So 2 weeks ago in this room, we launched 4 groups, 2 in Texas, 1 in Arkansas, 1 in Louisiana, and then they'll then go back to their local areas for 2 years and work on that. And the theme for our first 5 years is telling the story, storytelling, as a vehicle for sharing the good news. So you'll never guess, though, what the focus of our work will be. Paying attention. It will be on helping preaching students and preachers pay attention to what God is doing in Scripture, in their congregations and community, and in their inward lives so that they can inspire listeners to sermons to do the same thing. And Ruth, I'm with you as far as looking forward to more God moments in my life. I do not expect a burning bush or a parted sea or the risen Lord to stand in my path. But I am hoping for an experience more like Elijah's as he hid out in a cave from his responsibilities in 1 Kings 19. I'm not implying that I'm going to be hiding in a cave. But God says to him there, Elijah, come out, because I'm coming by. Come out and stand on the mountain. And so Elijah cowers in the cave. And there was a mighty wind that split the mountains and shattered the rocks. But the author of 1 Kings tells us God was not in the mighty wind. And there was an earthquake, but God was not in the earthquake. And then there was a fire, but God was not in the fire. And then there came the sound of sheer silence, or as it's sometimes rendered, the still, small voice. You have to pay attention to hear it. But if you do, you just might meet God. Not on some bright and distant day, but today, while you are at work. Thank you.